recorded live.
Hello, everyone. My name's Carl Shinneman, Director of Analytics and Review with Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it. One way a good friend of mine at a recent Georgetown Advanced eDiscovery conference described the content of ESI Bytes, which makes it easier to remember the name of the show, is it's Easy Bytes. I'm amazed I didn't think about that. Easy Bytes of electronic discovery information. So, Jeff Reed, thanks for the new tagline. Today we have a great show. So we have John Collins from the Ingersoll firm and Kelly Twigger from ESI Attorneys to talk about how to create an ESI data map. The world of data is always evolving, and keeping track of companies' ESI can be very important to implement effective legal holds. And our guests today have collective backgrounds in this area, and I did the math on my own looking at the bios, but at least 20-plus years in this field. Specifically, John Collins is the founder and vice president for the Ingersoll firm, one of the nation's leading ESI data mapping consultants. He has responsibility for ESI data mapping projects for a variety of international corporations, large not-for-profits, and Am Law 200 law firms. Interestingly, he's also developed a curriculum on information technology for legal and RIM professionals, which teaches non-technical lawyers, paralegals, and RIM professionals the nuts and bolts of how corporate IT systems work for the purpose of enabling legal and RIM professionals to better communicate with IT professionals. That's actually going to be a podcast I'm doing shortly, so maybe we'll have you on that one. Better communication between legal and technology. But prior to starting the Ingersoll Company, John worked at Autonomy Zantaz. He's been at Whitmont Legal Technologies, Renew Data, Interwoven with West Publishing, so a good range of technology-oriented companies. He's spoken all over the country on e-discovery challenges, has a number of technology-related articles and publication, and he's also a member of ARMA and the Sedona Conference. The other guest, Kelly Twigger, is the founder and managing partner of ESI Attorneys, LLC, a law firm dedicated to assisting clients with issues related to the management, preservation, and production of electronic information. Kelly works with clients in a number of areas to prepare them for managing and producing ESI, including assessing an organization's readiness to handle e-discovery, implementing and managing a comprehensive records and information management initiative, and recommending appropriate technological solutions. Kelly also acts as e-discovery counsel for clients in litigation and is generally brought in at the onset of the dispute to advise clients on appropriate process and strategy for handling e-discovery issues. She also provides training for in-house and outside counsel on e-discovery issues. Prior to opening ESI Attorneys, Kelly was a partner with the national law firm of Quarles & Brady LLP, where she established and headed the firm's records retention and electronic discovery team, including the firm's blog, eDiscovery Bytes, which I have found online a number of times when looking for ESI Bytes, my podcast site. So nice to meet you, Kelly. In her 12 years with Quarles and Brady, Kelly litigated hundreds of commercial litigation matters for a variety of clients, including Fortune 15 companies. She's a member of the ABA eDiscovery Committee, ARMA, Women in eDiscovery, and the Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production. Great to have both of you on board. And, first of all, I'll start with Kelly and then John. How did each of you become interested in the world of electronic discovery?
Thanks, Carl. Thanks for the introductions. I got started in eDiscovery when I happened to attend a conference in 2004 in New York City, I think that was put on by the ABA on electronic discovery. And quite frankly, I attended it more because it was in New York City and I needed some CLE than because of the content. And then as a result of attending, suddenly became the firm expert on electronic discovery and started and headed up Quarles & Brady's Electronic Discovery Committee, which then morphed into our electronic discovery and records retention practice there, which I headed up for 3 years before leaving to start ESI Bytes. ESI Attorneys, sorry. Now you've got me all confused on the language, Carl.
You'll hear from my lawyers next week. Anyway, great. And John?
Yes, Carl. I was kind of lured into eDiscovery. I was working for Interwoven and in the document records management group. and was getting some calls from some recruiters about joining companies in the e-discovery space. Wasn't particularly familiar with it, but eventually it sounded like a good opportunity with one of the companies, and I took it. And in retrospect, it seemed to make sense because my background's sort of a combination of legal and technical, and I didn't have any visions, I have to admit, when I started down that path of it leading to e-discovery. But I'm very happy to be in the space. And by the way, Carl, thank you very much for having me on today.
Yeah, and I should add, this was a really neat show because, the theory of ESI Bytes is you bring collectively experts from around the country to talk on things they know. Because I'll be honest, I know bits and pieces, but it's too big of an area to know all of it. And John's an expert in this area, and he said, hey, you haven't done a show on ESI data mapping. And I looked at his background, and he brought Kelly in, and so now we have a show. So I encourage anyone that listens and says, why haven't they done a show on this? And if you know that area, contact me. You know, it's not that complicated. I'd like to meet other experts as well. So let's jump right in, John. What is an ESI data map?
Well, Carl, from my perspective, the way that I define it is that it's a comprehensive and defensible inventory of an organization's IT systems that store information, or ESI, and it's an inventory of those systems which may be relevant to the organization's legal discovery portfolio, and that would encompass, at least with the companies I've worked with, litigation, regulatory proceedings, government investigations, or audits. And the ESI data map is something that's created via a methodical, systematic process which identifies that ESI and gathers the pertinent facts about the configuration and operation of the IT systems in which that ESI resides. And ultimately, an ESI data map should represent a good faith and reasonable effort to document the organization's IT infrastructure. And it's really the cornerstone for an effective records and information management and any discovery or litigation response plan. And I think that's been borne out in the conversations and the writings and what you hear from the experts is, you know, kind of the first step is you need to know where your information is and how it's being managed.
Kelly, why do organizations need an ESI data map?
Well, John kind of alluded to it at the end of his response there, but, you know, we're all presuming everybody that's listening is familiar with the new rules in the federal courts and now the state court equivalents, which are growing at a rapid pace that require or allow for the production of electronic information in litigation situations. And courts that are interpreting those rules have said that organizations have an obligation to understand the sources of their electronic information. And the defense of, Judge, we didn't think to ask that IT guy who left the company 3 years ago but had backup tapes in his car, isn't flying. So organizations need to have a detailed understanding of the IT infrastructure. There needs to be communication with IT as to decisions that are being made about how to store ESI within the organization, about perhaps keeping those IT guys from putting the backup tapes in their trunk. You've got to be able to continue to respond to discovery in a timely manner. Under the federal rules, that's a 30-day period. And if you don't know where your ESI is when you get those requests or when you have a duty to preserve information at the outset of a litigation, you're going to have a pretty challenging time doing it, and the likelihood is you're not going to be meeting your obligations.
Well, John, doesn't IT or internal audit already have a data map? I mean, they installed the systems. You'd think someone's keeping track of this stuff.
Well, it's an interesting question, and it's one that is going to vary across organizations. But having said that, my experience has been that in most companies, and of course, this isn't, I'm not speaking about every single company. There are exceptions, and possibly many of them. But in most of the companies I've worked with, and I've worked with large Fortune 500 companies, I've worked with smaller companies, there's not a lot of documentation about the IT systems to begin with. So the and Kelly has a good way of explaining this, but the IT people are really focused on, keeping the IT systems running, keeping them secure, ensuring that people have access to their email, they have access to their websites, to various collaboration tools. So IT is not particularly focused on documenting things and hasn't been up to this point. But to the degree that IT does have documentation, it's not what I refer to as an ESI data map. What they have is they'll have spreadsheets that have lists of servers. So they'll have a spreadsheet that lists all their file servers. They'll have a spreadsheet that lists all their line of business servers. And then on that spreadsheet, it'll have information like their IP addresses for the servers. It'll have the operating system. It'll say the model, is it a HP or Dell or some other type of manufacturer's system. What they don't typically have in that documentation is when was the server deployed, or if they have the information about when the server was deployed, it doesn't say when was the data that is on that system created, when was the data, was there any data purged. So the documentation that IT has typically is really focused on helping them run the IT shop. And really the type of documentation is going to be spreadsheets. A lot of people that are listening may have seen some of the Visio diagrams or graphical depictions, and those can be helpful in building a data map, but the problem with these documents is that they'll typically list all the different elements of the IT infrastructure. So it'll show you that in the data center there's a mainframe computer, and it'll show that there's 25 file servers, and it'll show that there's a rack of servers that support their SharePoint environment. But what the network map doesn't do is it doesn't tell you when was the data that's on those servers created. Has any of the data that's on those servers been purged? What's the configuration options on those servers that might impact what data is available or not available in a discovery context? So, you know, the IT documentation that legal and RIM professionals would want to have to manage discovery just doesn't exist in most organizations. And the problem is that a lot of the companies I talk to, the general counsel or the in-house lawyers, unless they've had some very pointed discussions with legal and with IT, rather with IT, will not. They don't realize that the type of documentation that they need doesn't exist within IT. They sort of have a presumption that, well, of course IT knows all this information about our servers and about our IT infrastructure, but in fact, they don't.
Isn't this just another example that people point to time and time again of communicating between the different practice areas and coming up with a common language?
That's exactly what it is, Carl. If I can add a little bit to what John's saying, is that the analogy that John is referring to that I usually explain to people is, if you think about your IT infrastructure, your organization's IT infrastructure as an enormous set of bookshelves, you know, a library, an entire library full of bookshelves with books on it. IT's job is to build those bookshelves. And IT's job is to take whatever technical requirements you have, whatever software you need to run, whatever corporate infrastructure you need to support, whether it's 5,000 users, 40,000 users, whether it's domestic, global, whatever it is, IT's job is to build those bookshelves to support the business that needs to be run. Where the information is stored on those bookshelves, sort of the Dewey Decimal System for your IT infrastructure, that's not IT's job. Their job is just to build those bookshelves and make sure they stay standing and that they continue to support whatever you want to add to them. And whatever information, the lawyer's job then is to come in and say, I need page 13 of the red book on the fifth shelf from the top in X room of the library. And IT doesn't know how to go and find that. That's never been their job. So because the legal people now have new requirements to be able to locate that information, they need to work with IT to figure out the best way to implement that within their organization. And if you get the right people in the room, whether it's the highest up person in IT at the CIO level, or whether it's a mid-level person, or whether it's a person from a third-party provider in an organization that outsources their IT functions, those people can talk. Legal can say, here's what I need to be able to find. Here's the information that I need to have about my ESI. I need to know how old our email goes back to, how many different places our users can store email, how many places I need to look for email when I have a litigation that impacts 30 different custodians in the company. And that's the type of information that goes in an ESI data map.
Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, otherwise it would seem to me visually you might end up with sort of the Chinese fire drill, you know, occurring
right.
in an old black and white type of visual with people running all over the place trying to figure out what's going on.
That's exactly right. And you know, some of these, all of these issues get very entwined. I know we're going to discuss some of them, but, you know, when you get those requests and you don't know how many different places email can be stored and you're trying to figure all that out on the fly and the IT people don't know why it is you're even asking or what the problem is, it's really hard to make that happen in a 30-day period, especially in a larger corporate environment where there are the responsibilities are spread out among so many different people.
Yep, that's the Coleman case. So
that's right. That's exactly right.
Anyway, before we jump into data mapping too deeply, one of the things that struck me about this is when I talk to in-house people about what they're doing to make their life easier in this area, and if they're pretty progressive, the thing that they typically point to is, well, we've invested in an email storage system at the enterprise level to store data so that we get rid of it when we want to and we don't lose it. How does that type of a project fit into an ESI data mapping project? Is it a component? Is it different? Kelly, why don't you take a first stab at that one?
It's very intertwined. Technically, from a physical project perspective, I generally handle the implementation of an email archive with an organization as a project separate from the data map, but I want to do them together. So if an organization wants to implement an email archive or they're looking at whether or not that makes sense for them, what you'd want to do is understand what your IT infrastructure looks like to begin with, what kinds of features you're utilizing. Most corporations run on an Exchange environment using Microsoft Exchange and Outlook, so we'll just use that as an example. There are options in an Exchange environment to allow you to keep email that may be sufficient to use within an organization. If an organization is going to implement an email archive, then all of the information about the email archive needs to be included in a data map. Coincidentally, John and I are working on a project for a client right now in which that's exactly what's happening, is they're implementing an email archive and we're in the process of going through all of the documentation with the vendor and the client and seeing what information needs to be included in the data map, how many different places email can be stored, what kinds of decisions need to be made within the IT environment to allow for storage outside that email archive, if there's going to be any. So the two projects really go hand in hand, but when I manage them for clients, I manage them as separate projects. Within a larger scale RIM initiative, you referred to RIM before, which stands for Records and Information Management. Typically, you know, a larger umbrella of a RIM initiative would include appropriate policies and procedures, a retention schedule, a data map, and some form of email management, whether it's an archive or other, and then putting together the ultimate sort of guide for your outside counsel that incorporates all of those things.
John, can't we just buy some kind of software system that can automatically create a data map by searching everything?
Sure, if we get our magic wand out and wave it. It's one of those paradoxes with technology that never ceases to fascinate me, which is when I talk to attorneys that aren't particularly technical, there's sort of this paradox of looking at technology as this complicated black box that they don't really understand, but there always seems to be this concept that there's a big red easy button on top of the box and you can press it, and because it's on computers, you can just search everything and collect everything and have it all done nice and neatly and easily. And the fact is, no, there is no data mapping or software out there that will automatically create a data map. Now, if there's vendors listening to this or software companies, there will be some objections from people that say, no, we can do that. I had a conversation with a vendor about a month ago. But the bottom line is this. Yes, there are software programs that can crawl and through certain types of interfaces with systems tell you that you have connected to your network. It'll tell you that you have 3,000 Dell OptiPlex 300 desktop computers and you have 10,000 Dell such and such computers. It'll give you some information. And there are software programs that will gather some information about the IT infrastructure. There are programs that will crawl information and index it so you can do searches over it. But what those technologies don't do is, first of all, there's not one that can do it across everything, despite what the vendors claim. There's not one technology that's gonna create that comprehensive data map. Number two is that the information that they gather is going to typically be information that's not particularly useful from a discovery perspective. So if you've got something that tells you you have 3,000 Dell OptiPlex laptops and 300 HP such and such file servers, it'll tell you that this is the model, this is maybe the storage capacity, this is the IP address, this is a serial number. But what it doesn't tell you is when were the home directories on that server deployed and who are their users of those, who has home directories on that server. So you don't really get the substantive factual information that you need about the data or the ESI that's on that system. So having said that, though, Carl, there are software programs out there that do provide some level of functionality in the data mapping context. But from what I've seen, and I'm not saying that I'm an expert on these software programs. I don't work for those companies. But from what I've seen, they look to be mostly workflow-oriented programs where you could take a data mapping project and try to run it through the software, and the software will allow you to basically conduct your project management, send out questionnaires, collect information, and then serve as a repository for the information that you've collected. So I think that's an important point to make. The software programs would have some value as the potential repository for the information that you gather in your ESI data mapping project. So it could be the place where you put the information about the ESI, the date ranges, and the nature of the information, that type of thing.
It's interesting. I focus further down the chain on litigation-oriented software, and concept searching is something people are looking for easy buttons too. And all types of data doesn't process through these things very well. Sometimes you got to process the data. Everyone hopes for the easy solution, but unfortunately, technology will get you part of the way, and that's why process is more important than technology, which is harder work.
Exactly.
But it's job security for all of us. So
that's right.
That's
you know, Carl, I would add that the types of information that technology generally can gather are not necessarily the types of information that are important in a litigation setting. How many different sources of information can one custodian in an environment have? How old is that information? What are the retention policies that are attached to it? I mean, if somebody came up with this product that you could gather all this information, store it, keep it up to date, or perhaps integrate within a corporation's systems, I think even if the product existed, I don't know of too many organizations, there's maybe 10 in the country who have done enough legwork in this area to have a program that is so solid that it could even be drawn on by technology.
You know, people talk about these things and they try to create tools for e-discovery. People think e-discovery is a bigger field than it is, okay?
Yeah.
And that's partly because a lot of the cost components, the labor that goes into it. But reality is this is a niche. And you got to look for tools outside of the niche sometimes to be effective.
And that's a good point there, and I think that I just started working with a company that they are very cost conscious. This is a large company, but they're very cost conscious. And at the end of the day, what they want is they want to use an internal piece of software that they already have, that they already paid for, as their data mapping repository, and it's a piece of software that has been around for 20 years. It's a piece of software from HP that's basically was built by HP so that companies could manage their service desk requests or help desk requests. When people have a problem with their computer, they can call in, and it tracks the different stages at which the resolution of the problem is at. So what they want to do is they want to use this non-eDiscovery software as a repository for information about their system. So there's, I mean, the point I'm making is that, you brought up that it's a niche market, and that's definitely true. But I think that what this company is trying to do is a great idea, is leverage some of their existing software to see if it's workable in the discovery or e-discovery context.
Yeah. Well, Kelly, why can't we just wait until we have a piece of litigation and then create a data map? I mean, it's easier to get budget in those situations anyway. I mean, what's sort of the pros and cons there?
It is easier to wait and to get budgeting, that's for sure. The pros and cons, there are more cons than there are pros, and that is because you are taking on a tremendous level of risk, and it's also going to cost a lot more. So while you may have a budget, it's going to take up most of your budget. The hardest thing for me, because I've done so many of these data mapping projects, to think about trying to do it in litigation is, one, if you do it in litigation, you're not going to have a comprehensive data map. You're only going to cover the sources of information that are implicated for that litigation. So its use is going to be not as broad as if you create it pre-litigation. Second, because you're going to have to do it as a Chinese fire drill, your risk of not getting all of the sources of electronic information, not covering all your bases, not understanding every nook and cranny that you need to, is much higher. And outside counsel has to be able to stand up before a judge and say, "Judge, we went through, we talked with IT, we created a data map, we identified all of the possible sources of electronically stored information in this organization." And the minute they open their mouth and say that, it better be true. It better be true. We've seen examples in cases where it hasn't been true, and the lawyers and the parties have been burned badly. So creating it in litigation, it's also much more costly. I mean, you're going to be hiring people. You don't have as much opportunity to interview vendors and understand what your cost options are. It tends to be, holy crap, we have to get it done. Let's just do it, stick with who we have, and go forward, rather than taking the time to figure out who the appropriate team members are and getting it all together as you do in a pre-litigation situation.
So, John, how would you suggest going about creating an ASI data map the right way? You know, what tips do you have?
Well, I think that I kind of have my standard spiel that I give to people when I get asked that question, and it's basically there's about four or five things that I'll mention. The first step is the legal department needs to do an inventory of the litigation, both historical and prospective, that they've had, and understand what kind of documents, what kind of information has the organization been asked to preserve and potentially produce in the past, and what do they anticipate in the future. And that's a critical first step, because we really need to understand that first. And the second step is to really survey the universe of IT systems and applications that the organization has. And that's basically just the way I think of it is looking, flying out into space and looking down at the company and saying, okay, what's the universe of applications? And that means finding out, do they use Microsoft Exchange? Do they use Lotus Notes Domino for email? But it also gets into the details of what kind of line of business systems do they use, what ERP system do they use, do they use SAP or Oracle E-Business Suite. So that second step is finding out the full universe of their IT systems. The third thing is to take the first two pieces of information, and then, of course, the one of the things I didn't mention is you need to have a project team that consists of, it needs to be a cross-functional group, so you need people from IT, you need people from legal, you need people from records or the information management, so RIM, records people, and then possibly, depending on the nature of the business, you may need business people as well. But that team needs to sit down with the first two pieces of information, the type of documents and information that have been requested in the past, and the universe of IT systems and applications that the organization has. At that point, the organization can then start to prioritize, or what I like to call tier, the applications based on their relevancy to the types of information that the organization has been asked to preserve in the past. So the things that the organization is most concerned with, or that they've been asked to preserve most frequently in the past, or the types of information that are most critical from a legal perspective, would be tier one. So systems that I've found usually fall into the tier one bracket would be email, file servers, and then in some companies, the financial information, which is typically going to be housed in either the ERP system per se, or it'll be in the ERP system, which stands for Enterprise Resource Planning, or it'll be in a business or data warehouse. So those would be tier one, and then there'll be secondary applications that fall into tier two, and those are applications that the team says, you know what, we've been asked to preserve this in the past, but it's not frequent, so we'll call that tier two. Now, the reason you do the tiering is the level of detail that you gather in the data mapping process is going to vary based on the tier. Tier one applications, you're going to spend the most amount of time gathering detail about, and you're going to gather the greatest level of detail. Tier two, you're going to get a lesser level of detail, and so on. So I've worked with companies where we'll have three tiers, maybe four, but typically you don't go beyond that. And then once you've decided the tiering, next step is to gather detailed information about the systems based on their tier. And the gathering of the information is going to vary, but at the highest level, at that tier one level, typically what you do is you inventory the systems through a series of worksheets and questionnaires and interviews. So you're actually asking the IT people to answer questions, detailed questions about these systems, and then you're if you're doing that in a survey format, you follow up with an interview or a follow-up conversation with the IT people. Once that information is gathered, then it's the role of the author of the data map to, and this is one of the critical elements, I think, is to take that information, translate it, and compose it into a document that's understandable to the non-technical. So it's really taking that technical verbiage, it's taking the technical information about the infrastructure, and trying to translate that into something that a legal person or a RIM professional can understand. And then once that composition is done, then it's a process of keeping it up to date. And I think we have some questions later on in reference to keeping it up to date we can talk about. But that's kind of it at a high level.
Okay. And Kelly, now you've gone through these steps that John has described or done some format of that. You now have a data map. How do you use an ESI data map?
With my clients, I use a data map as the key to the process of implementing a litigation hold, preserving the information, and then deciding what to collect and filter and subsequently produce. And the way that I do that is by taking the sources of ESI and the information about the age of the ESI and other bits and pieces that are included, and put them into a custodian interview checklist or a questionnaire that can either be distributed electronically or done in person interviews with the custodians to determine where they actually have information of the available sources that information can be stored on the network. Where do they actually keep information about this particular litigation that might be relevant or responsive to requests in this particular litigation? And then after you have the responses to those checklists or custodian interviews, then you know right away what the key sources of information are that you need to focus on.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take that information together with your knowledge about the retention periods for information, particularly with email, where organizations often have very short times for keeping email in the active inbox, and know what you need to go after right away. The other thing that the data map is just immeasurably invaluable for is providing the contact information for the IT people who manage those systems. So if in a litigation I know that the three software applications that are important are all customer relationship management applications, because the key issue is whether a sales representative made a representation to a distributor about something that led them to believe they had greater rights than they have for a particular product. All of that information in those applications is what's going to be key. So we need to be able to preserve all the information in those applications right away. The data map collects the key people in the organization who manage those applications. And we know what the age of the information is in those applications. We know whether people have it on their BlackBerries. You know, for instance, I use this example because Salesforce.com is an application that a lot of organizations are using these days. They're using it over the internet. Sales reps can access it from their mobile devices. Their iPhones have applications for it now. And you have to know what kind of information is retained on the iPhone, what kind of information is retained on the BlackBerry, what's different about that information than what's on the server. The data map's going to tell you that level of detail. The types of data maps that John and I put together give you that level of detail so that you know. When you know that those are the applications that are implicated, you know right away what you have. It also allows you to assist your counsel in being able to, so you minimize cost and risk because you can go and get the information that you know that you have, and you have policies and procedures in place that are defensible to a court if you have, say, 30 days of information, but not the previous 2 years because your retention policy is to keep everything for 30 days, and you kept it as soon as you had notice of the suit. Then it allows, the data map allows you to be able to assist your outside counsel with negotiating with opposing counsel in whether it's a Rule 26 conference or a state equivalent on what electronic information you have that can be produced, that's available to be produced in litigation, as opposed to, you know, everybody stonewalling the other side about, yeah, we're going to figure it out and we'll get back to you. You know right away what you have, and you sit down with the other side and you negotiate. You can negotiate your preservation obligations to the extent that's an effective strategy, and you can negotiate what's going to be produced in discovery so that you minimize cost and risk there too.
You know, I was thinking of something here, Kelly. And different organizations do different things, and some organizations try to do more in-house. So suppose someone hasn't called you to help them put this data map together, yet they have one and now they're being sued and you come in as outside lawyer. Do you just take the data map and run with it, or do you challenge the data map and try to fill in gaps? I mean, is there an audit of the data map in the beginning to make sure you're not missing something?
Well, the data map needs to be kept up to date. And generally, depending on the litigation portfolio for a client, I recommend anywhere from a quarterly to a every 6 months double check of the data map just to review the general things. A lot of times when we go through a RIM initiative, we sit down with the organization to figure out from an IT perspective what additional initiatives or projects that IT is going to be undertaking within the next calendar year so that we know what parts of the data map might need to be updated. And if you establish that communication with IT, then they might even filter the information to you as it happens, and you can just keep the data map up to date.
Yeah, I was actually looking more at, forget about keeping it up to date. You now step into the case, we're trying to identify what's at stake here, what we're going to look at, what we got to preserve, where's the data, here's our data map. Okay,
right,
great.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Glad you have one, you know. Tell me about the data map. How did you put it together? I mean, what sort of steps do you do as a lawyer when you're handed a data map that you're seeing now for maybe for the first time?
Yes, I'm sorry. I was trying to get to your question, but I hear you. I would definitely challenge it because I would be the lawyer, or your outside counsel would be the lawyer who needs to stand up in front of the judge and be able to defend it. So you certainly need to understand the process that the organization went through in creating the data map. As far as auditing it from a perspective of the information that's included in the data map, I would also want to make sure that particularly the sources of information that are implicated in the litigation were covered in sufficient detail to be able to make the statement to a court that you've identified everything within those realms as potential sources of ESI.
Now, John, Kelly started providing some information on this, so I'm curious if you have anything to add to it. Is an ESI data map like Windows software? You know, hey, you need your data map upgrade now. And how do you suggest upgrading?
Carl, Kelly touched on it. When a data map is put together, one of the initial conversations that typically occurs is how do we keep this thing up to date? And I think it's important to take a step back and understand a couple things about the data map. So I think in the context of keeping it up to date is, number one, the data map is not meant to be a infallible Bible that you would, you know, hand to a judge or hand to somebody and say, hey, this is our IT infrastructure, this is it, this is precisely correct, this tells you everything you need to know. What the data map is designed to do is enable the folks that are managing discovery and managing litigation and managing the RIM program, it's designed to enable them to, in a snapshot fashion, get a clear understanding of the nature and extent of the systems, the IT infrastructure of the organization. The data map is meant to get the user 90%, maybe in some cases 95%, maybe in other cases 98% of the way to understanding what the systems consist of. But the data map is not a replacement for having to have a conversation, as Kelly alluded to, with the contacts that are identified in the data map. And one of the most simple, but probably one of the most valuable aspects of a data map is just identifying who the appropriate IT contacts are for the various systems. I mean, the feedback I've gotten from clients is, I had no idea who to talk to about the SAP financial modules. We had no idea. Now I do with the data map. So number one, when you think about updating it, is to understand that the data map largely is not meant to be, you know, it's difficult to keep the data map up to date to the second because of the nature of organizations' IT systems. You know, who has a BlackBerry device today is probably going to be different from who has a BlackBerry device tomorrow. Who's on email today is going to be different from who's on email tomorrow. Now, some of the software programs out there do state that they have integration with various types of IT systems. But again, I haven't seen that to the level of detail where, you know, it's real-time information. So that if you pull up a screen that says these are our BlackBerry users, it's literally those are the BlackBerry users as of this second. So going back to how do you keep it up to date, it's really a function of a couple things. One is, I think in any situation, you're going to want to have some kind of auditing schedule, like Kelly alluded to. Now, if your litigation portfolio is light or not particularly intense, then I think that, you know, most organizations would be comfortable with either a quarterly or an annual audit of the data map, where basically the owner of the data map is responsible for contacting the IT people who are identified in the data map and on some type of a schedule, having a follow-up conversation, and there's a checklist that we put together for the follow-up that ensures that the right questions are being asked. So you either have a quarterly or annual audit. But the interesting dynamic, though, Carl, is that in organizations that have a lot of litigation, they're going to be using the data map frequently. So those conversations between the people that are using the data map and the IT people are going to be ongoing, and they're going to be fairly extensive. So through that process, a byproduct of that process is going to be keeping the data map up to date. But even in that kind of context where you do have a company that has maybe a pretty significant litigation portfolio, you're still going to want to have some type of an annual or quarterly or monthly audit process. And that speaks to, and frankly, I mean, the other key thing to this is that there needs to be an owner. I mean, the data map needs to be somebody's baby. It needs to be something that someone takes ownership of and cares and feeds it on a regular basis. It can't be something that you just create and say, great, we got our data map, it's done, and then put it up on a pedestal. It's something that requires a lot of attention. And I think I think that the key thing, though, is keeping it up to date. It's not easy, and it's not simple because, I mean, IT infrastructures change and they vary, but there's a core of information that's in that data map that should be valuable, you know, regardless of how much the organization's IT infrastructure changes and shifts and so forth.
Okay. This is a question I'm really interested in because it touches on a project I've been working on, which is trying to store project management information, maybe even online, to try to get ready for a case. But Kelly, is an ESI data map discoverable, or do you think it's privileged?
Carl, this is a question that comes up every single time we talk about this subject. And, you know, the first thing I would say is that it's not a question that has been resolved by case law at this point. I think that you can make a very strong argument that a data map is privileged, but there are a couple of caveats I would make to that. We discussed this issue at some length with a federal and a state court judge at our seminar on Wednesday at the Eastern District Bar Association here in Milwaukee. And some input that they had was to make sure that the data map includes the thoughts of counsel. You know, if you're talking about the data map being privileged, you're talking about it being privileged as work product, and which would mean that it needs to be prepared in anticipation of litigation. And so, you know, then the question comes up, if you prepare a data map prior to litigation, so we've talked about preparing data maps in, you know, way in advance, you know, litigation preparedness or in the litigation itself. If you prepare it 2 years before the litigation commences, is that in the anticipation of litigation? The judges that I've talked to about this, you know, they want to promote parties managing their electronic information and understanding the sources of the information, so they're leaning more towards saying that it is reasonably anticipating litigation, because were it not for litigation, would you be creating an ESI data map? Probably not. So I think you very much can make that argument. There are some relevance issues here that need to be discussed. You know, in a particular piece of litigation, maybe, you know, 3 or 4 sources of information might be relevant to the dispute or more. Is the entire data map relevant? Do you need to produce the entire data map? Likely not. There are a couple of ways to deal with the privilege issue as well in terms of the cooperation. You know, we've all talked about or heard about the Sedona conferences, yeah, the cooperation proclamation that a lot of judges are signing on to now. And one of the ways it's been suggested to deal with the privilege issue is perhaps allow opposing counsel, you know, a sneak peek at the data map without waiving privilege, or sitting down and simply discussing it with them. You know, sit down across the table and say, look, I'm looking at the client's data map. Here's what it tells me about this type of information. The one argument that I think can be made from the other side of discovering the data map is that technically a party should be allowed to take the 30B6 deposition of a corporate representative and gather the information that would be put in the data map. Now, in the corporations that I've done data maps for, you'd have to depose a heck of a lot of 30B6 representatives to get all that information, but it can be done. So if you're allowed to, if that data is otherwise discoverable, why would it be privileged as the work product? Again, that's where including the thoughts of counsel or that the data map is ordered by counsel are all important to the consideration of how the data map is put together. So when organizations are looking at doing it on their own internally, you want to think about how are you going about it. And that is a lot of the reason why oftentimes I retain John through my firm for clients as an added layer of privilege.
Okay. John, really taking a crack at summarizing the show thus far, what are the biggest challenges encountered in attempting to build an ESI data map?
Well, a couple of thoughts on that, Carl. The first one is really convincing. Well, I mean, it's really the first one is just surfacing the issue that the organization does not have an ESI data map already. And I always try to call it an ESI data map because when you talk to IT people and you say data mapping, it starts to conjure up images of data warehouses and business intelligence and things with, you know, actually working with data. So I try to call it an ESI data map. But you know, one of the big challenges is just let the in-house legal department recognizing at a certain point, hopefully earlier than later, that this information doesn't exist and that IT does not have at their fingertips the information that they need. So that's one key issue. A second issue is that once an organization recognizes that they want to have and need a data map, another huge challenge is getting everybody on board with cooperating and participating in the project. And that challenge speaks to getting the highest level executive sponsorship possible. It needs to really come down from the CEO level, the C level certainly, but preferably the CEO level, to say this is something that's an imperative. It needs to be done. And while the economy is what it is, and there are challenges, this is something that needs to be completed. We need to do this data map. So that's another challenge: is getting that executive sponsorship. Then once you get the executive sponsorship and you tackle it, the challenges are really working with the IT people in a way that is non-disruptive to their normal workflow, to their normal jobs. Because frankly, and I've heard this on a number of podcasts and a number of speakers, and on some of your shows, Carl, the IT people are, they have day jobs. They have a full plate. And in most organizations that I've worked with, companies have either laid off IT people or they're running a leaner shop. So IT people are already doing two or three things or have more responsibility than they had before. So getting time with the IT people, and then once you get the time, being able to get the information out of the IT people that is accurate and comprehensive. It is incredibly challenging in some instances to get accurate, comprehensive, and historical information about an organization's IT system, because the people that were there 8 years ago when CC Mail or Lotus Notes was their email system, now it's Microsoft Exchange, those people aren't around. And finding out whether or not they migrated email from the CC Mail or Domino servers to Exchange, and whether or not they migrated NSF files to the new Microsoft environment, sometimes that can be very challenging, but those are issues or questions that need to be answered in order to have a defensible and accurate, you know, data map. And so I think those are some of the key things. And I think the other challenge that I run into is companies don't want to spend the money to bring in outside help because they want to try to do it internally. And the challenge that you run into is doing these types of projects really requires people that have both the legal and technical expertise, because you really need to understand what depth of information you need about the IT systems, and that's informed by the legal process. Because if you look at any IT system of any complexity, like, and let's take something like Microsoft Exchange, I mean, if you look at the Exchange manuals, they are 1,200 pages of information about how you can configure Exchange and how data is stored and how the system operates. You know, out of those 1,200 pages, there's probably maybe 50 or 60 pages that would relate to the issues that you're concerned with in a discovery context. So you need somebody that's got the expertise to be able to work through that and understand what's the essential, you know, what are the essentials. And, you know, I've run into companies that do have that internal expertise. They have people that were, you know, formerly an IT person that went to law school and, you know, got a law degree, and now they're working, you know, in the company as sort of the e-discovery manager. So I am running into that in some companies. But, you know, the companies that don't have that expertise, really, they really need to find that somewhere.
Hey, Kelly, okay, go ahead.
Oh, no, and I was going to say, I think Kelly could probably speak very eloquently to the executive sponsorship and how critical that is, because we ran into that on a particular project where we just weren't getting anywhere because the lower well, I'll let Kelly talk about it.
Yeah, well, actually, Kelly, why don't you jump in on that one? Because John, you did a good job on do-it-yourselfing approaching, and but executive sponsorship, I think, is probably where a lot of this starts. So why don't you talk about that?
Sure. Kind of echoing exactly what John said and going to the executive sponsorship. In order for a program, any kind of program, no matter what elements of it an organization undertakes, you know, policies, email management, archiving, data mapping, anything. In order for this kind of program to be successful in an organization, it has to start from the top down. There just is no question about that. It really has to start with the CEO. That I might even say is the floor, but if you wanted to call that the ceiling, then the floor would have to be the general counsel. Because the reason it needs to start with the CEO is it has to filter down from the CEO to the CIO and the general counsel and to the heads of the VPs of the various business functional groups, because it includes everybody. When you're talking about email management and you're going to institute an archive and you're going to set an organization-wide retention period for email for the active inbox, well, your business people need to be considered on what that retention period is going to be. And if you're going to decide how many other places you're going to allow users to store information, your business people need to be consulted. You need to know what they need to run the business. These legal requirements should not run the business. They should fit within the confines of the business. And then the legal people need to be able to stand up before court and say, Judge, this is how we run our organization based on the needs of our business. We understand how it operates because we have put together this data map and worked with our business people to put policies and procedures in place. We have instituted a litigation hold protocol that takes our business operations into account, and this is how we stand before you today with all of these procedures and processes in place. I'm not sure if I answered that question exactly.
No, you did. You did. You took us from needing the executives into how you actually use it, so that's good. That was a bonus answer in there.
Okay.
Thanks, Kelly.
So, John, sort of the last question, because we danced around a little bit on the economics, and since right now we're in sort of budget season, how long does it take to create an ESI data map? Ballpark, what does it cost, and is there an ROI involved in this?
Well, I think that on the first one, I mean, creating an ESI data map in the sort of proactive fashion that we've talked about, as opposed to a litigation specific data map, it generally takes, and it's going to be based on the complexity of the IT infrastructure. And the interesting thing is, it's really based on how centralized versus how decentralized an organization is. I've worked with some large companies that have a very centralized IT infrastructure, which means that the data mapping process can move a lot quicker, a lot faster, because in a centralized environment, you have essentially a single or maybe just a couple of IT groups and then individuals within those groups that you need to go to, versus a decentralized model where you might have a company that says ABC on the door, but they might have 10 different business units, and each business unit has its own individual IT infrastructure or its own elements of an IT infrastructure. So a good example would be, I've worked with companies where it'll say ABC on the door, and to the world, it's ABC company, but behind the scenes, there's 10 different business units, and out of those 10, 5 of them each have their own Exchange servers. So, and how they configure the Exchange servers is different between those 5. So from a timing and cost standpoint, the consideration is really how centralized versus decentralized is the company. And then a second consideration is, what is the complexity of the organization's IT systems? Some companies run their business mostly on off-the-shelf type applications. They don't have a lot of custom line of business applications. So if that's the case, then that tends to make it easier, because off-the-shelf business applications, it's easier to map because the information about how they were built, how they can be configured, what the different options are readily available. And for people like myself, I can create worksheets and so forth easily that way. It's where you get into the customized systems, where companies have systems that are built specifically for their business, to run their business, where it takes longer to create the data map, because you have to get in and really dig into the details of how those systems were built, what the technologies are, and et cetera. So that's kind of a long-winded way of saying, how long does it take to create an ESI data map? The quickest that I've built a enterprise ESI data map has been 8 months. And that was to create a data map for a company with about 6,000 employees, about $1.5 billion in sales, operations across the world, but we really focused on their North American operations. The longest it's taken to build a data map is 2 years. And the reason that project took 2 years is I got to about 90% completion, and then, and this was about a year ago, and then the group, the primary people I was working with to create the data map, they were laid off. So there was basically this void for 6 or 8 months where they were just scrambling to keep things going, and I was not able to complete the data map. So you do have maybe not those types of drastic types of situations, but you do have intervening circumstances that come up. But having said all that, I think it's fair to say that you can do a data map in 6 months, 8 months, but you could also have a situation where it might take a year to a year and a half. And it's a challenge. How much it costs? I mean, I've talked to AmLaw 50 law firms where doing a data map might be something that's hundreds of thousands of dollars. some of the big consulting firms out there. You know, it's, I mean, the cost is really going to be based on what their billing rates are and how they go about the process. But I know that, you know, at least in my world, you know, I think data maps, you should be in the ballpark of anywhere from, you know, maybe $100,000 to $200,000 or $300,000 as a cost range for building a comprehensive, defensible data map.
Well, that's great. Okay, go ahead.
I'll add something here a little bit. I haven't started doing this as much with clients at this point, but I see where a client who isn't interested at this point in building a comprehensive data map, maybe because they only have two or three sources of electronic information that are produced, or they have a very slight or no litigation portfolio or low risk, where they might look at starting to map particular sources of information. For instance, gathering all the information about email. Email is generally, you know, 65% of the information of an organization's ESI, or more, could be more since that statistic came out. And that, so simply understanding email is gets a big piece out of the puzzle. You know, so doing it a little bit piecemeal, you might be able to do. But the biggest obstacle, just going back to the challenges that John was talking about before, it's the communication aspect, which is the reason why it has to start from the top down. So for listeners out there who want to do this within their own organization, establishing that communication within your organization and really having the whole organization on board before you try to do a project like this is going to be the key, because it's going to cost a lot more and it's going to take a lot longer if you do not have the right team and the right communication established from the very beginning.
Well, that's great. Well, on that note, I think that's all we have for today, time for today, but thank you for joining our show. Very interesting stuff. And to our listeners, thank you for listening to ESI Bytes. For a complete listing of ESI Bytes shows, visit www.esibytes.com. And remember what we always say here, you should visit ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. I think this is a good example of this show. So this is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Jurnov. Have a nice day.
Thank you, Carl.
Thanks, Carl.